Welcome back to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. We bring on Ron English for his third episode, and we talk through him starting his career with galleries. And we couldn't be more stoked that he's got two more episodes after this, and they're going to be so good. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can like, follow, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. You can jump on all socials at Toys on Tap. And if you want to support the show, you can jump on the Patreon, patreon.com/toysontap. That's where you'll find all kinds of goodies, extra content, and whatnot. And if you are like, man, I want more of Toys on Tap, we currently have the Barfie that is in stock, and KMB is fully funded and on its way through production as we speak. Now let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. We have gotten to the point in your story where you move into galleries, and we are at this little point, but from what we've talked about, there are parts that you were in galleries, but you might not have made a living off of it. So can we start there? Can we start at the when you first started getting into galleries and what that kind of looked like?
Like, I think that I did a prestigious show, like, when I was in New York at OK Harris, but that didn't really give me a lot of money because it was just fabricated to be photograph stuff. But, you know, it was high profile. And it was also interesting because he was the only person that looked at everybody's slides. Mm-hmm. So he was the only person that authentically knew everything that was going on.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if Mary Boone was saying, look, I've put together a stable of the 7 best artists or the 15 best artists. Really? How do you know?
Yeah.
Who did you look at? Oh, well, so-and-so I met at a cocktail party, and, you know, and I mean, she's playing a different game, but, you know, maybe they don't need to be the best artist. They need to be promoted the best and have the best connections, you know, with people that might buy the art. But I liked him because he looked at everybody's art. So you feel like that you in competition with the whole spread of artists that had appeared in New York in the last couple of years, you know, Ivan Carr picked you. So,
yeah.
But I think later I showed with I had right around the same time a show with, it was called Stendhal back then, and it was more big paintings that sold for more money. Mm-hmm.
Balancing entering into the gallery scene earlier on in your career and trying to balance that between almost this persona of like, I'm a famous artist or like I'm this type of artist, but then also doing Billboard Liberation and that kind of stuff. How did you work those two together?
Today I'm painting and tomorrow I'm doing a billboard.
Yeah. Did it change? Because people knew you were doing both of them. Did the gallery, did that kind of space not like that you were doing the other stuff?
I don't know. I think they probably, I don't know. I don't know what they thought about it. I do know that I remember Harry Stendhal, the Stendhal Gallery, I had him on billboards with me, and he thought it was a lot of fun and interesting. And he was Afghani, and I couldn't tell like how long, you know, I think a lot of American culture was kind of interesting to him, and that, oh, Ron just steals the billboards and gets girls to have abortions on billboards and does crazy stuff and dresses crazy. And
yeah,
probably seemed kind of fun to him. And I did go to a wedding. And it was kind of interesting because they were Afghani, and all the women kind of dressed as if it was the 1970s, like, but super decked out with short skirts, but they all had to sit on one side of the room and the men all sat on the other. So, I mean, he was definitely, you could tell that his the core around him was a very different culture, and that he was in America to make some money. And he had that kind of, it was interesting. It was a clash of cultures, but I think the fact that he would go on the billboards probably meant a lot, you know, that he didn't mind me doing that.
Yeah. Can you take me to the point in which, because there's a discrepancy between being in galleries and not making money, and then the point where it actually starts to click over, where you start to make, can you take me to that point in your career? How did that even start?
Well, if I was going to pick a point, I was bumping along and doing okay. You know, like NEA grant or just whatever artists did back then. But I wasn't, I mean, I was super ambitious towards the art and making great art. I probably wasn't that super ambitious towards like amassing money. Because I was, you know, I had a big studio in the East Village, and like for a while I had a big studio in Brooklyn, but I was quite content, and it didn't bother me that I stepped over dead bodies to when I left my house in the morning. I kind of got really used to that. But then when I was going to get married to the woman you were just talking to, I think she'd grown up in that type of situation. She wasn't unaccustomed to it, but I think she didn't want to live like that anymore. And she didn't, she's like, we got to get out of here. And so, well, if we're going to live in Tribeca, not in East Village, then I'm going to need a lot more money. And that kind of motivated me to look for bigger opportunities. So the thing that kind of probably flipped me was a lot of, they did Absolute Herring, Absolute Rocher, Absolute Scharf. And I thought, wow, that really profiles these artists on a bigger stage. And I think that at that point, people were, the prejudice between you doing commercial work and doing fine art was kind of waning. So it seems like that was actually a positive thing, not a negative thing. So I approached Michel Roux, and he set me up with doing an Absolute English, and he also bought a bunch of my paintings. So suddenly now I had money, and I was able to afford to go get like a floor of a building in Tribeca and live a different lifestyle. It's just weird that people, like, if I need money, I can find money, you know?
Yeah. I mean that
I'm motivated. Yeah.
Yeah. There is nothing more American than that motivation to get money that we see.
And I also understand that 90% of what I do isn't going to appeal to anybody, that, you know, nobody wants to pay money for this. I'm way ahead of the game. I'm way out there doing different things. And you have to be a little behind the curve to catch the money train, because people have to be acclimated to it, which means somebody has to pave the road, and then you have to drive down the road. But most of the time I'm paving the road, and then sometimes I stop and drive down the road that I paved, and that's when you can actually make money.
Yeah. But
yeah. You know, you can't be too far ahead of the curve.
The first galleries that you're in when this happens, I mean, getting ready for your own show is insane, especially like motivated to, you just want to make a better life for you and your wife. And
my paintings became more commercial because they, you know, I needed them to be. And I don't think you're ever supposed to call your work commercial, and it has to have some pretense behind it. But, you know, you kind of make that pretense up, you know, like Mike Bidlow made fake Picassos, but every wealthy person wanted a Picasso and they weren't going to get one. They were all gone. And it gave, now then they could do it like as a kind of conceptual move. But at the end of the day, they had a Picasso looking thing on their wall, and it was legit because it was part of that conceptual movement.
Yeah. When you did that first one, what was it like getting ready for it? Because that seems, one, like you're getting ready by making your art more.
What up, toy nerds? This is Ray.
And Dave. Go check out our brand new YouTube channel, The Toy Rats.
We make toys.
We talk about toys.
We talk about old toys.
And new toys.
And toys that we make.
And we're just a bunch of goofballs. It's a good time.
We make fun of Dave a lot.
I'm all right with that. So, yeah, if you get a chance, go check out Toy Rats on YouTube. You won't be disappointed. You might be.
Yeah, you could. Who knows?
You gotta check it out.
Toy Rats. YouTube.
Bye. Public focused or more commercial. And then two, you're getting ready for an art show that was, or a gallery that was just specifically about you. Mm-hmm. So how did you like almost reorient yourself to make sure that happened?
I had been painting for Kustabi, so I bang out a painting every 3 hours. I mean, his style was a little simpler and blendy, but you could really whack those things out. Mm-hmm. So my stuff was a little more complicated, but I don't know. I never seemed to have a problem with, I could paint like the wind, okay? I could paint,
yeah,
you know, and probably because I had done a lot of painting for other people and stuff, and I knew how to motivate and go. So I never saw that as a problem. You just stretch a bunch of big canvases and have the time of your life, right?
Yeah. Well, I did see that. I mean, you did that recently, the Last Supper. And it was like every day you were showing a new clip of how far you'd come. And it was leaps and bounds ahead of what I would assume a painter was doing. And you were so quick on that painting.
It took about 3 months. Yeah. So I don't know if it was quick, yeah.
It just seemed like it was going way faster because the canvas is massive.
Yeah. It's not going that fast. It's like, okay, today I'm going to do the internal workings of this guy's head, and I'm going to do the underpainting, and then maybe it'll take another day to do the brain part, and it'll take another day to do the skull part, and then so it actually took quite a long time.
Okay.
And since I'm older now, it's like, you know, I'm on the floor and I don't know, it was really harsh on my body making that painting, where it wouldn't have been when I was younger.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's once we did a video, we put out an album called Popaganda, and one of the songs was Billboard, and then it was the Gefkins about, you know, my doing the billboards. And so we made a 3-minute video of me doing like 100 and some billboards. Mm-hmm. It goes by in 3 minutes, pop, 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 pop. And then, you know, people, hey, that's interesting. And then the one guy stood up and said, you know, that was like 5 years of his life.
Yeah. Like
3 minutes. It's like, oh yeah, I never thought of that.
Social media has a way of taking
it. I never knew whether I should take a picture every day because, you know, it makes the process seem quicker than it actually is. And sometimes, like in the beginning of a painting, like I'll splash a bunch of paint. When I did a big painting called Homer Simpson's Cartoon Creationism.
Yeah.
It was a giant painting. But I started by painting Homer, like kind of a photorealistic of like looking up at him, like the Jackson Pollock thing where he painted on the glass. And then I splashed a bunch of paint. So I filmed that. And then people just think I splashed the paint. And then I spent the next 3 months, like every one of those strips, like rendering them. So they were 3D and flying around. But people think somehow like I just magically mixed the paint and flung it. And that was like a half a day's work to create that. So sometimes I never could figure out, do I want people to think that I can just magically throw paint that lands like that? Or do I want them to know how much work goes into it, you know? I mean, yeah. I don't know. Collectors are all different. Some probably don't think about it. Sometimes I realize they want to know how long I spent, and they want to think I've spent a very long time. So like a guy walks into the gallery and he goes, okay, how long did it take you to paint this show? So there's like 15 paintings. And I said, it took a year. And he goes, okay, well, and I can tell he kind of likes a certain painting or something. He goes, oh, how long did it take this painting? Oh, well, that took a month. How long did that one take? Well, that took 2 months. And, you know, because I wanted, when I got to his painting, that it took like 3 months to make it or whatever. But the, you know, he didn't add it up because, you know, how did this one take 3 months? That one take 2 months. And I did the whole thing in a year and it's 15 paintings. It's like it, but I think they just want to hear that you know, sweated blood on their picture, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, they want to know that you put in everything.
Right. Sometimes they don't want you to paint the same image ever again. Uh-huh. Like, oh, I'm going to buy the lady lips, but I want a written guarantee that you'll never paint lady lips again. And it's like, I can't do that. I mean, I'll use it. It's like one of my iconic figures. You know, I'm not going to take that out, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, from their point of view, it's like, you know, I bought a Andy Warhol Marilyn. It's like, I kind of need to know how many he did. And if I could stop him from doing those, like if in 10 years he thinks I got to revisit that because, oh my God, the line of collectors is halfway around the world, you know, I'm going to do it, you know? But then maybe I think that's going to lower the value of mine because now there's more. So they're kind of looking at it from a different perspective, but.
Yeah. When you get into this gallery and you start doing that, tell me a little bit about the trajectory that kind of sets you on, because up until this point, before you have this solo gallery spot, your story is split between doing gallery and doing liberations of the billboards and doing and just finding pockets of art. But then when you do this solo thing and you start making your art, what you've called more commercial, what does that do for your trajectory and how does that kind of change where you were headed?
Well, I did a little bit of an interesting thing because, you know, because I came from the photography and the fabricated to be photographed and a whole, you know, like Diane Arbus and Gary Winogrand and this whole different way of thinking about art than what the painters were thinking about. You know, when I became a painter, I thought, well, at first I thought like almost as a conceptual thing, I want to try out being a pop artist because I didn't really like pop artists. I thought they were too pandering, you know?
Yeah. It's,
you know, Andy didn't really do, you know, he did it like mechanically or whatever, but he didn't really like push the image at all. He just like repeated the image in a more degraded kind of way. So I thought, well, if I'm going to, I want to be a pop artist because I don't like pop artists. You know, like it's like, I don't know if you're ever at a party and they're arguing about some artist and you think, well, you don't really like what that artist is doing, but I'm going to argue the other side because everybody's on this side and it's more kind of like compelling to do the other side. And sometimes you keep arguing the other side till you're like, you come out on the other side.
Yeah.
But I thought that would be interesting thing to put myself through to like, I'm going to experience, you know, because it's not just you make these paintings that look a certain way and they're different than your paintings before. It's going to give you a different life. Understand what I'm saying? So like, if I'm doing the weird fabricated be photographs, I'm going to show in different galleries. I'm going to be perceived differently. If I suddenly start doing I did these kind of two layered pop paintings with the blurry image on top. So they're very, easy to identify as mine and they sold very well. But suddenly you have a different life. And then I got the Absolute ad and then, you know, I got sent to Japan and a lot of other opportunities opened up to me because I was part of this wave of painters where if I would have stuck with the photo thing, you know, I would have rode with that crowd and had a different life. So you do like the art you make dictates what kind of life you have.
Yeah. And so as you're doing this, is it starting to change you as an artist as a whole? Because you're having to navigate changing your art to be more public facing is this changing you?
Well, you're probably not anybody. Do you know what I mean? If you think about it, I mean, we like to think that we're this individualistic person or whatever, but we're probably not. We're probably just...
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this.
Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV-2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet. Oh my, we're doomed. Wait, salvation. Hooray. We're saved, DOV-2. Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures. DKE.
Lots of choices along the way. You know, like there's a weird thing as you look back on your life. So if I had become a circus clown, people go, so tell me the story about being a circus clown. Well, you know, I went to the circus when I was 7. And then later I went to photograph the circus when I was in high school and
met
performers. And, you know, it's, you know, I could tell that story. You know, I did love the circus. I was obsessed with the circus. And had I become a clown, I would look back over my life and say, this is how it happened, you know, because of all these series of events. But I didn't become a clown. I became something else. So then I re-examined my art from the prism of like, you're an artist. So, well, you know, then you think about, I remember when I drew under my grandmother's table for all the kids. And I got a lot of feedback. They loved the drawings and it really gave me some impact, you know, and made me feel really good. So I kind of followed that path and I would look for moments that kind of led me down that path. So, but you know, I think it's, you know, we're less than we think we are, you know,
yeah,
and we're more reacting and we're also imitating, you know. I was probably seeing like, I worked for one day for Nick Nicosia and I helped him build some sets and he was doing very, we were in Dallas. So he was, I was still a student. He was doing very well in New York for a minute. And, but he was also frustrated that, his photos, he blew them up big, but they didn't have the impact of actual painting. And also he realized that because we were building all the sets and doing all the stuff, you know, that a lot more work went into his photograph. The same with me. I worked for like a month on building up a photograph. But then it's a photograph. And so the perception of what that object is, well, that's a photograph and then that's a painting. Now, meanwhile, the guy spent 3 hours on the painting. Mm-hmm. So, but he's getting more money, he's getting the best room, you know, he's getting hung in the best spot. He's getting more accolades. And so maybe Nick thinks, you know, maybe I should try to be a painter. And I think maybe for a minute he did some paintings that he used in the photographs. But I don't know if he ever, you know, went for it. But I kind of did because, you know, I hate to admit it, but it's like, yeah, I want more money and more accolades. Thanks.
Yeah.
And it considered a more serious art form. So why did I want to, you know, work in the ditches of some, you know, off-brand art thing, you know, that's not taking that seriously. And of course you got to remember this is Nick was doing okay a little bit, but mostly there weren't that many people like making a big splash with photography. Like until I think Sherry Levine and you know, those guys, but yeah, up to that point, you know, painting was the grand thing that people did. And that was the serious art form. So
yeah.
when you, I mean, you said you didn't like pop art as much. And then you move into what we all know now as Popaganda and, right. and that stuff. Did the galleries kind of shape that trajectory? In- yeah.
Well, like, and also, like I said, when you go, I remember, like, I was, you know, I was saying that you argue for some artists that you're not that into, just to think, keep it contrary and keep it alive. And then you start to understand that artist better because now you've made their argument, you know? And so kind of when I started creating that kind of art, I made the argument for that kind of art, or especially like for the updated version of that kind of art. And so now I have a whole different attitude about it, you know?
Yeah.
Now I can defend what I'm doing. It makes conceptual sense, you know?
In early 2000s, following these first galleries, what does it look like for you? Are there a lot of galleries that are reaching out asking for you to do pieces everywhere? Are you kind of having your choice of wherever you want to go? What does this look like early 2000s for you?
Well, it takes a long time to make a show, and usually you stay with the gallery for, you know, until they fold or quit paying you or whatever.
Yeah.
but they, you know, it's like, it's what they say, you know, you build up a demand for your work. So now that's what you do, you know?
Yeah. Because this is also around the era. The one that keeps coming to mind is Marilyn Monroe with the Mickey painting on her. And that,
you know, I look at all the old cliches, like lightning never strikes twice. It's like, well,
Empire Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 2.75 inch or 1.18 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now functional. Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters. Empire Blisters.
You know, hits the Empire State Building every day. So it says, you know, the definition of the fool, somebody does the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. But that's what happens. You know, you do Marilyn and Mickey and people think that's fucked up, you know, and everybody's kind of hostile towards it. And then somebody goes, yeah, that's kind of interesting. That's like, it's the mother of pop, or like it's, and slowly every time you show it, then more and more people get acclimated to it. They like it. Mm-hmm. You know, where they didn't like it before, it was like, you know, when Stravinsky played The Rite of Spring and they all had a riot, and it's like, but their brains kind of got their mind around what he was doing, and then they kind of came back to it and loved it. So you know, I'm that fool that does the same thing over and over again and doesn't only expect different results, I get different results. So that was interesting to have, you know, a demand. Like, I think that was maybe the first really famous painting I had that, you know, people like, I want a Marilyn with Mickey, or, you know.
Yeah. When you,
so I sold a lot of those. And also I don't know if you know much about galleries, but mm-hmm. you know, they usually start with about 12 artists, and usually they kind of actually start the original gallery built around those artists, and they believe in those artists. Maybe they knew them in college, but you know, then some of them actually just don't sell, and maybe they'll give them three shows without selling, but that's, you know, that's some major real estate, you know, where you're, you know, and you got a staff and it's just not moving and people aren't going for it. And at some point you know, because it's a business, you have to cut bait on them. And the ones that, you know, start popping off, you kind of go more with them. And then they actually get, you know, then you get offers from other galleries because they realize that you're viable, you know, and that you're building up a very important collector base, and that there's a demand for your work, and that maybe they could tap that demand. And so, yeah, but at some point, you know, the art has to sell, you know?
Yeah. I've seen some of the stuff that you've done with Delusionville and some of the stuff in which you're building almost these interactive style galleries. Usually, from my understanding, I work with toys, so galleries haven't reached out. In galleries, when they reach out, they say, we would like this many paintings over the course of however long, fill these walls. At what point in this do they finally say, we would like whatever you will give us?
I think that they, well, from their point of view, they hang around with you like a little bit, but you know who they really hang out with and go to lunch with and go to dinner with is their collectors. So their collectors will put lots of pressure on them. Oh, I see Ron's having a new show. Could I come in 2 days early? Could I have first pick of the litter? I bought stuff before. You know, they'll make their argument, but then they'll go, I really want a Guernica. Would he be willing to do one of those again? And then you have to negotiate with your dealer because you're super obsessed because you just come up with this, all these new concepts you're working on. And in, yeah, maybe he'll let some of those go in, but you know, he still wants to make sure that he's trying to keep his collectors happy.
Yeah.
Cause his main relationship is with them. And yeah. That's, you know, he wants to come through for them, you know?
Yeah. In doing gallery stuff and moving forward with your art career, in the name of making a name, making a better living, all those things, do you feel like there was a part of you that got lost along the way, or a piece of you that made a certain type of art that you no longer could make that you missed a lot now?
No.
That's I love that answer more than anything. So often it feels like if we progress, we have to give up parts of ourselves, and to not have done that and gotten this far and like be in galleries and do all these things, that's impressive.
Hmm. I mean, I think maybe when you're changing, you may think, I know when I left behind the Fabricated to be Photographed, I mean, I always thought I would go back to it one day, but you know, but then you don't want to. Okay, so like, this is a little off subject, but I lived in Dallas, right? Mm-hmm. There was this club I liked to go to, Mother Blues. That's where like Led Zeppelin would show up and stuff, and the Rolling Stones. And it was like a rock and roll club. Mm-hmm. And I had like long blonde hair and we're all black. And I fit right into the rock and roll scene of the late 70s, you know? But I was like 19 years old. And, but the it said it was for people 19 to 25. And I thought, I love this club so much. And it's going to be super depressing when I turn 26 or, you know, 25 and a half, and I start feeling like I don't belong here anymore. And then I'll have to leave because this is for people from 19 to 25. But, yeah. You know, by the time I was, you know, 22, I had aged out of the club. It wasn't interesting to me anymore. So do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's kind of what life is, you know? So you think, oh, well, I'll return to that. And that helps you leave it. But you never want to go back.
Yeah.
You just think when you're leaving something that you'll want to go back. But in reality, you never want to go back.
Yeah. In these early years of doing a lot more gallery work and sticking with certain galleries and moving to other galleries and doing all that, what we would call like the art scene in it. What are some of the ones that stick out to you the most that you, as they were happening, they were just the end all be all for you?
Well, they're all a lot of fun. And it's also fun because I used to always make a painting at the very last minute. Mm-hmm. So it'd still be wet on the wall. And I remember I was at one show and there's a guy standing there with his wearing a suit. And he just like leans on the painting. And I'm like, sir, can you not lean on my painting? And he's like, hey, fuck you. Lean on your painting. And he walked out the door and there was paint all over his back. Even with the big schmear in the painting, somebody still bought the painting because it was a Marilyn with Mickey. And, you know, I don't know. But I don't know. I guess I don't. Yeah, a lot of people get real crazy at art openings. And sometimes you get way too much liquor. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's very emotional because you're giving away. These are your paintings. Like you talk about the Last Supper painting. That was my painting.
Yeah.
Well, first, I looked at the painting every day for 3 months. And that was my life. You know, but then it wasn't really the painting yet. You know, mm-hmm. It was like half, it wasn't the painting yet. It was like setting up layers. And then finally the final painting emerges. And then we were going to have that dinner party and they had to arrange all that. And it took a long time. So that was my painting. So if you came to visit me in my studio, it's like, I could go check this shit out, you know, that's mine, you know, and it's not mine anymore, you know? So there is like, you're sitting there and like, we're having this dinner party for the painting and you're just, you know, they had me facing the painting at the big dinner table, but it's kind of like when the night's over and you're just, you look at that painting and think I may never see that painting again. It's not my painting anymore. If I go, I went to see some of my paintings and, you know, sir, step back. You're too close.
Yeah.
And it's like, last year I could have took a piss on that painting. Now I can't fucking get near it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
which is so crazy. It's something that's interesting. It almost feels like you're giving pieces of yourself away as you, in exchange for all these different things, for popularity, money, all those things. And it's like, it is heartbreaking almost that you don't, you'll never see these pieces ever again.
Well, it's kind of like, I was working with a salesperson for a castle art gallery. So they were going to do some shows in the fall, but you know, so you work with the salespeople and kind of explain your art, but I said, so I want you to sell me something, you know, just so I see how you do it. And they were trying to sell me like a Bob Dylan, like original. And I said, well, if I buy this painting, do I get to meet Bob Dylan? And they're like, no. And I said, well, here's how you should sell the painting, you know, not to tell you how to do your job, but it's like, you're not going to meet Bob. Take that out of the fantasy. But for however long it took to make this painting, and the painting that was an original was, it was almost like a Manet, like the barmaid at the Follies. It's like the weird, sad woman behind the bar. But it was the viewer sitting next to somebody at a bar, and it's a barfly woman, and you could just see like in her face, like the life, you know, beaten into her, you know, and she's still kind of weirdly beautiful, shining through it. And there's a lot going on in that painting. I was surprised for somebody of his musical and lyrical talents that he could pull off something like that visually. But I would say, you know, you had to tell the person, it's like, you're not going to meet Bob, but for 3 weeks, every day, this was his fucking life. This was the center of his life. This was all of his energy, all the same energy that made Mr. Tambourine Man and Idiot Wind. Like, all that guy that made that, this artistic genius, for 3 weeks, that was the complete focus of his life. That's all his life was about. And that's every day he just woke up and had a cup of coffee and went to that. And just, that was him.
Yeah.
And you own that, you know?
It's almost like we own your time.
You own a little piece of the soul, you know?
Yeah, which is so incredible. We're encroaching in on the mixture of this episode and next episode, because next episode is really centered around your toys and like how that function. And so I guess to kind of put a cap on this one, as you're working with galleries and they're usually wanting paintings and fill the walls and do those things, how did you start incorporating figures and those types of things into this? Because those don't generally mix all the time.
Yeah. I was building the little sets and creating and sculpting the things by hand.
Yeah.
Out of air dry clay. So they probably, I still have them, but they're super fragile. I would never sell them because they're just, somebody would destroy them, or you know, people don't want something that's that fragile. But and then I'd light them, but that was giving me this weird pop in my paintings, and this weird, I had something else that other people didn't have. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a technique I was using to get to it. And then I thought, when the toy thing happened, the first thing I thought is, I could use these companies to do the sculpts for me. And mm-hmm. then, like, free assistance, you know? And so that's what was in my mind, that, oh, if you guys want to do toys with me, then that'll save me a lot of time on sculpting. I'd probably get people to actually a little better than me at sculpting to do them. And then I'll drop them into the paintings and, you know, so yeah, that's about all I was thinking at the time. Yeah, but it was interesting because, when the toy thing, it was like Eric So and, Michael Lau, but they just figured out that you could do small runs, with the Sofubi or whatever, the soft vinyl, the way they pull it, you don't need to do like an injection mold.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, like, I think Michael Lau would just, like, once every 2 months would have a thing at his art studio, not like a gallery or anything. And then he would release maybe 200 figures or whatever. And the people line up and they come in and get their figure and then they would leave. And then that's how you got them. And so they kind of started this culture of like small run toys.
Yeah.
And, but I think when other people got involved that weren't the artists, that were like, oh, we want to start a little company and make small run toys and tap this thing, you know, and hit the American market. I think they didn't really know who to go to, you know, what artists should we recruit to do this? Mm-hmm. And first they used like a lot of hip hop guys and stuff, but people that weren't really artists or maybe famous graffiti artists that didn't really have characters per se. So, and I think that that didn't work as good. And then somebody said, hey, maybe you should check out the Pops Realist. They actually have character based art, so a lot of them have original characters. And then I think that's how I got kind of called to task in that industry very early on.
Yeah. Is there a gallery that comes to mind that was the first in which they asked for paintings and for figures at the gallery?
I don't think that's happened, has it?
I don't know.
I don't think they don't think they, I mean, a lot, sometimes they'll take some of the figures, and then if somebody buys a painting, it's like, hey, he makes these cute little art figures. But I don't know if they take them seriously. It's just like, oh, that's a fun thing Ron does.
Yeah, which is so crazy, because on this side of it, we love it, and it's an art form.
Yeah.
And well, we're just...
There was one night I was doing a show at Alouche Gallery in Soho.
Mm-hmm.
But we were dropping a toy with a Kid Robot, but it was like they were like 2 months apart, I believe, the two dates. And then people kept moving the dates, and then until like it became like, well, it looks like we're going to have these two things on the same day. Do we really want to do something like that? You know, they were a few blocks from each other, and I figured it's completely different crowd, or I thought it was, you know. And so we went and did the toy signing for a couple hours, and then I went to the art opening. And I told everybody that I signed a toy for. It's like, down the street, I'm having an opening after this, you know, of my paintings, and there'll be, you know, free high-end wine, and it'll be a really fun party and a lot of cool people. And so I invited every one of them, and then only two guys actually showed up. So it seemed like that, because I was like, you know, they seem like, I don't know. So just come on, it'll be fun. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's like that was a different world to them, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe they'd never been to a big gallery, or maybe they felt intimidated by it, or they just wanted their toy, or I don't know. But yeah, that's when I realized it was kind of two different worlds.
Yeah. I think this is the perfect place to cap it, because we're about to enter the second world in the next episode. Yeah. So this is perfect. Just like every other week, this episode will come out next week, and we'll promote and do all the things. And
just one quick thing about the toys, though, you know, whatever I thought that was going to be. And, I did make political toys and sexual toys, and I went all over the place the same as I did my art, where, you know, that was a very small industry that said absolutely no sex or no politics. But I immediately put them in, and it actually turned out very well, because the culture grew. But the last thing I want to say before we sign off today is, like, the toys opened up so many worlds that I never expected. And I'll tell you about that next time. But I had no idea what the toys were actually do for me.
I do have a question for you. You have a grenade dinosaur that you made, and it's, if I remember correctly, it's like 6 inches, something like that.
Yeah.
That
one right there somewhere.
You have a larger version of that as well?
No.
Is that something that you still produce?
We have some, but that's one of the things I hand paint most of them.
Yeah.
So like in 2 weeks, which doesn't matter for this, we have a thing in New York. So I'll release a bunch of those. Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. I have another version that has wings, and he's pulled the pin on himself.
Uh-huh.
And the pin is like a peace sign.
But that's cool.
Sculpture. I haven't made the physical. Hopefully I'll probably do like one-offs for this installation, but
yeah. Awesome. Awesome. I always see that piece, and I'm always into that. It combines the dinosaur and grenades so well that it's like, there's something eye catching about it that is too good.
And also with AI and everything, and we realized that we are agents in the evolution of another life form. And that kind of tells that story in a cute little way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I do. It does give a little spin off of like, the extinction of dinosaurs all can be held in like this like bomb. Like, we are all just as fragile if we pull the wrong pin.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. Ron, thank you so much for giving me your time